The people wanted a king. The people wanted a king in the portion we're studying in Samuel. And the people got a king in the form of Saul. And they were not impressed, at least not some of them, because they had to drag Saul out of the baggage area where he was hiding. And so some of them scoffed and said, "A king, yeah, right. This guy's not much of a king, is he?" So in the section today in Samuel, we're going to see whether Saul proves himself or not. Chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Now Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you." In other words, we surrender. We surrender. Jabesh-Gilead, if you remember the land of Israel, you have the Mediterranean over here, you have the land of the main body of Israel over here, you have the Jordan River, and then on the other side of the Jordan River towards the east, you had those tribes that Moses allowed to stay there. If you'll remember, we just finished the book of Judges not that long ago, that Jephthah had his own problems with the Ammonites. That the Ammonites decided that hundreds of years later, they were going to come back and ask for the land which they claimed, which wasn't even taken from them, but was taken from the Amorites. And so Jephthah beat them solidly. But Jabesh-Gilead was kind of on the eastern side of the Jordan River, not far from the Sea of Galilee, so it is up in that area. So they were, in some sense, less protected than the rest of Israel because they were on that side of the Jordan River, and the Ammonites were coming against them. So Israel had the Ammonites on the east, and they had the Philistines on the west. So they were kind of caught between these two groups. So you would think the men of Jabesh, if they said, "We surrender," that the Ammonites would say, "All right, another city taken, let's move on." Verse 2. But Nahash, the Ammonite, said to them, "I will make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus I will make it a reproach on all Israel." Yeah, that sounded like a fair bargain if you were one of the inhabitants of Jabesh. If I had lived there at that time, I would have considered that not to be the best solution. The elders of Jabesh said to him, "Let us alone for 7 days, that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then, if there is no one to deliver us, we will come out to you." I'm sure the leaders of the Ammonites were thinking, "Great, we'll get to kill some more Jews, some more Israelites. Woohoo! We don't have to come to them. They'll come to us. No problem." I guess they figured that the land of Israel at that point was disorganized and disoriented and that hardly anybody would come. Verse 4, "Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept." Now, it's difficult to figure out the chronology of these sections of 1 Samuel, to try to fit together everything that was happening, because that's not the point of the text, so the text is very vague about this. It seems like there was still a pretty fair gathering at Gibeah after the anointing of Saul as king. It seems like this was relatively soon. Their relatively soon is different than ours. I mean, I have personally been in the situation of flying to Europe and the very next day being in a meeting, and then 2 days later the meeting's over, and then flying back to the United States. It wasn't quite that easy for them. They had to travel long distances to meet at Gibeah. It was a couple of days' travel. They had all their provisions. Arrangements had to be made. Caravans had to be organized and all sorts of things in order to come and go. So if it was a few days or a week or so from the anointing of Saul, it is still conceivable that there is still a large multitude of people there. A large multitude might have stayed even because they were trying to figure out what was going to happen next. We just anointed Saul as king, now what? Saul himself went back to plowing. Verse 5, now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen. And he said, what is the matter with the people that they weep? So they related to him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. So Saul's early career, well, very early career, very, very early career, was done in the power of God and in the plan of God. The Spirit of God came upon him mightily, in a sense he was acting no differently than any of the judges of Israel. Verse 7, he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. Okay, so a couple of things going on here. First of all, his rather gruesome party invitation or war invitation was a piece of an oxen. But notice also that Samuel's name is also mentioned here. So in a sense, it seems like some sort of a transitional period. If you're saying, why in the world does Saul seem to be so united with God's plans at this point? And then you hear Samuel's name be mentioned from time to time in this section. And Scripture didn't hint at that in the last section that we saw, but we're seeing it in this section, that there seems to be in some ways in which the two of them were both operating together in leadership. Verse 8, he numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. Now we're talking army here. But also notice something interesting, that even at this early date, that Judah was considered to be separate from the rest of Israel, that it was looked at as its own separate tribe. Verse 9, they said to the messengers who had come, thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you will have deliverance. So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. And the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you. So it seemed like they had sent out all these messengers, and the impression they wanted to give to the Ammonites was that nobody came. So that the next morning, the Ammonites would say, all right, let's go do the deed. Nobody's there to stop us. The next morning, Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp at the morning watch and struck down the Ammonites till the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. So it's got to understand that it wasn't like they sent the messengers to phone ahead. So Saul and Samuel sent out the messengers to tell them, and then a little ways behind them comes the army. So the messengers would take a couple of days, maybe a day or two, to get to Jabesh. And the army would take a couple of days also to get to Jabesh, but they were a day behind the messengers, which is how Saul could tell them to that in the morning, your deliverance is coming. So it was a great battle, a great victory. They were routed. The Ammonites were routed. Not only did they save Jabesh Gilead, but the Ammonites had made quite a penetration into Israel even to get to Jabesh Gilead, and now they were beaten back. So Saul had not only reconquered Jabesh, but also probably a sizable portion of the east bank of the Jordan. Verse 12, then the people said to Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. So it seems like, once again, there is this team there, that the two of them are standing in front of the nation, and the people are talking to Samuel, and Saul is giving his take on the matter. Verse 13, but Saul said, not a man should be put to death this day, for the day the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. He's certainly starting out on the right track. Right? He's not reacting with vengeance or personal strife against these men who had spoken against him. What a change we're going to see in him going forward as he sinks down into insecurity and fear and even eventually madness. Because here at the beginning, he would sparing these men, but yet he was not willing to spare David later on. Verse 14, then Samuel said to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Chapter 12, then Samuel said to all Israel, behold, I have listened to your voice and all that you said to me, and I have appointed a king over you. Now here is the king walking before you, but I am old and gray, and behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth even to this day. Here I am. Bear witness against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken, or whose donkey have I taken, or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? I will restore it to you. So he's tying up loose ends. Samuel at this point is saying, now the transition period is over, Saul has proved himself, and I am retiring, and now before I retire, let me just make sure that there is nobody here who has a case against me. If they do, then I will make it right before I retire. Verse 4, they said, you have not defrauded us or oppressed us or taken anything from any man's hand. In other words, they gave him a clean bill of health. He said to them, the Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day that you have found nothing in my hand. And they said, he is witness. In this case, in terms of anointed, he's talking about anointed king. He's talking about Saul, who is there. So he's just a testimony that he can leave with a clean sheet, a clean slate. And Samuel said to the people, it is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron, and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. So now take your stand, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he did for you and for your fathers. They gave Samuel a clean slate, and now in a sense, he's talking about the Lord as their king, and that transition from the Lord as king into Saul as king. And the point that he's going to make is that God at no point let them down or disappointed them. At every single point that he was faithful. Verse 8, when Jacob went into Egypt and your fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, so he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the army of Hazor, into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. They cried out to the Lord and said, we have sinned, because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. But now deliver us from the hands of our enemies, and we will serve you. And the Lord sent Jerubbabel and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around so that you lived in security. Now this next verse is kind of interesting because that gives us the clue of why all of a sudden they wanted a king. When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, "No, but a king shall reign over us," although the Lord your God was your king. So apparently when they saw Nahash start his campaign and start taking cities away from Israel, they said, "We're not going to deal with God as king anymore. We want ourselves to have a real king." Quotes around real. Because I guess they figured that God is so demanding. He wants us to walk righteously with Him in order to deliver us, but a human king isn't going to be that picky. Verse 13, "Now therefore here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you." In other words, God's still in control. It might have been your idea, but it was God who picked this guy. It's God who allowed you to do this. Verse 14, "If you will fear the Lord and serve Him, and listen to His voice, and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God." Okay? So this is not saying that the king is going to protect and save them, that both of them are under God's control. They both are to serve God. It's not like God and the king were in parallel. It's not like God and the government were two parallel things and never the two shall meet. But rather God was over the king in this case, and it was God's command and control over him. Because in verse 15, "If you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers." In other words, if your king's not going to help you, your government's not going to help you, your prosperity, your power is not going to help you, that if you rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you. Don't trade reputation with God. He doesn't care. Verse 16, "Even now, take your stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord that He may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king." So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day. And all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. God was just putting his seal on the conversation, his exclamation point. Verse 19, "And all the people said to Samuel, 'Pray for your servants to the Lord your God, so that we may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king.' Samuel said to the people, 'Do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart.'" Not just as a side, not just as a hobby, not just as something to do when it doesn't cost you anything. With all your heart. Verse 21, "You must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile." Futile is a little bit too weak a word for this, for what it's trying to say. We hear futile and it's like, okay, well, that's not too bad. You know, you try to open a jar and you can't get it open. Your efforts are futile. So you get a lid gripper and you open it. Right? So it was futile until he did something different. But this word, futile, is the same word that's used in, I believe, in the beginning of Genesis, the idea of a waste or a desolation, a desert, a worthless, an empty place, something that's worthless or valueless, something that picture someone who's house is just blown up and he's sitting in the ruins. That's the futile we're talking about here. It's something that God is talking about, turning aside to other gods or to other solutions than his, and the result is going to be a disaster. It's going to be annihilation. It's going to be a wasteland, a desert. It's going to not work out well for you at all. And in fact, look at the history of Israel and see how it worked out. See how it worked out for the northern kingdom. They turned aside and they were obliterated. Southern kingdom turned aside, and despite their king and despite all the political maneuverings that they were trying, they still went into captivity. Their nation was destroyed. Their city, the walls were torn down. That's what we're talking about with futile. That's what we're talking about. Verse 22, for the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. So God was saying, yeah, it's going to be tough, but God's not going to abandon you. And now Samuel's talking in verse 23. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. One aspect of this, we can look at this in national perspective. That there is somehow this idea of American exceptionalism, and what made us exceptional was our desire to follow God nationally. As verse 25 says, but if you do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away. People who take God bless America as a slogan, God will bless America if America follows God. America does not follow God. God will not bless America. God has done great things not only for nations but for individuals. That's the second way we can look at this. That it's not that every person that follows God will be healthy, wealthy, and happy. Well, I guess they'll be satisfied. They'll be happy in a sense. They will probably be healthier than they would have been had they not followed God. They will, and yes, I will say it, probably be wealthier than they would have been had they not followed God, only because God gives us his principles for finances. If we follow those finances, things will go better. And if we are indeed following God, oftentimes what blows up people's finances are, well, sometimes it's something they can't avoid, but oftentimes it's sin issues. Some addiction to some substance will blow up finances. Somebody who's unfaithful to their spouse commits the sin of adultery, blows up their finances. So in that sense, I say that. It's not that everyone's going to be rich, but by serving God, we are living more wisely, which in itself, inherently, will be better off than if we had not. But there are believers still who die of awful diseases or who are who suffer, who are victims and not the perpetrators, just because we live in a fallen world. But yet, in a large sense, that if we follow God with all our hearts, then our lives will be much different than it would have been otherwise. Sometimes I do that exercise. I kind of look back and say, well, if I hadn't have been a believer, I would have done this, and 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 the result would have been catastrophe. If we're honest with ourselves. It is too easy when we are faced with some crisis to forget the things that God has already done for us, as they did when they were asking for a king. They're asking for a king because they didn't trust God to deliver them, but yet God had brought them out of Egypt, out of one of the strongest nations of the world at that time. And he brought them out and protected them for hundreds of years against these mighty nations all around them. And now, because Nahash of the Ammonites came against them, the same Ammonites that were trounced by Jephthah the judge a few generations before, that scared them enough that they wanted a king. Come on. Piece of cake for God, as he demonstrated. Do not turn aside from following God. Remember the things that he has done. And it's looking a little bit ahead with Saul. Continue to follow God even in the midst of success. Success can be just as dangerous, even more so, than trials in your life. It certainly was for Saul. His success as king caused him to move further and further away from God, caused him to put more and more of the glory for accomplishment on himself and not upon God. And the result was madness. The result was the loss of the monarchy from his son. Years wasted chasing after David. That was the result. Let's close in prayer. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for all the things that you have done in our lives. And forgive us for being scared and worried when crises erupt. Continue to teach us to trust you, that you would indeed be our king, that we would follow you with all our hearts and never turn aside to the right or to the left towards anything else to deliver us, but that always and everywhere, in every way, we would come unto you, that we would arrange our lives in ways that please you, not for our own glory, but for yours and that of our Messiah, Yeshua.